My name's Duncan West. I'm a non-executive director these days of a range of life insurance and general insurance companies. I'm delighted to be chairing this session this afternoon, which, although we've got the after-lunch session, we've got the session on risk culture, conduct, risk and reputation, which is probably the number one hot issue in risk management today. So I think this is going to be a fascinating session, and I hope you're going to enjoy it. And I hope you're going to have plenty of questions at the end for our esteemed panel. Everybody has a view these days on risk culture and conduct risk, and no one really has the answers. So it's going to be fascinating to hear what our panel have to say. We all are long on problems and short on solutions on risk culture. And APRA and ASIC in particular are active in advising us that risk culture is very important, but short sometimes on answers to what we should do. Our three presenters today are very experienced. They are highly qualified, and each has a unique perspective you'll find over the next 45 minutes or so on risk culture and conduct risk. And I think you'll find each of their presentations thought-provoking, and I hope that as we struggle together with this issue of risk culture and conduct risk, that you will have plenty of questions at the end. I would encourage you, there is a prize for the best question of the day, which is an iPad mini. And if we can't get the best question out of this session, I have no idea which session we're going to get it out of. So I'll encourage you to think of your questions, both here in the room and online. Each of our presenters will present for about 15 minutes. And then there'll be an opportunity for about 15 minutes for questions. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our first speaker, who is Harry Tuukkalas, the managing partner of Blackall & Pearl. Harry has significant global experience in the fields of risk and compliance. He commenced his senior career at NAB, eventually becoming the Australian head of operational risk. He then joined Bankers Trust as regional vice president of risk management for Asia Pacific, and then returned to NAB as Global General Manager of Operational Risk and Compliance for the whole group. Harry subsequently became the founding Managing Director of the Bank of Cyprus in Australia and is currently completing his PhD on risk culture. So welcome, Harry.
Thank you for that. Okay, let's get technology working here. So I guess the first question is, why are we having this discussion about risk culture? Well, it's become a topic of national conversation, I guess is why, isn't it? It's at the heart of many corporate failures. There's no question that regulators are looking at it far more closely. Since the GFC, conduct-related issues have cost some European banks up to around 30% of their P&L. And some global regulators, including APRA, now expect boards to also form an opinion about culture. So the first point I'd make about risk culture is that there's no such thing as risk culture. Right? No such thing as risk culture. It's organisational culture and the way that impacts your management of risk. I've never seen an organisation that had a great risk culture and a bad organisational culture and vice versa. So it's organisational culture and the way that impacts your management of risk. And when you put it into that sort of context, it becomes much more logical to start managing it. Because whenever I hear a CEO talk about a crisis in their organisation and say, oh, it's simply an isolated event in a part of our business that isn't reflective of the rest of the culture of the organisation, that's a real red flag for me. So the way we look at it is it's organisational culture and the way that either hinders you or enables you to manage risk. So our view is those aspects of the organisation's culture that influence its management of risk is the definition. The other point I'd make is that we don't tend to see risk culture as good or bad. It's just too simplistic and binary for something as multifaceted as risk culture in any organisation. So our view is that it should be about articulating what the leadership, what the board, what the organisation expects in terms of conduct and behaviour of their people, finding a way to assess whether they're enacting that expected behaviour, and then shaping or bridging the gap accordingly. So it's much more about alignment as opposed to good or bad. So that's some background on risk culture. We find that the regulators we've spoken to, so we've spoken to APRA, we've spoken to the FCA in the UK, spoken to the Fed in New York, OSFI in Canada, they tend to share an understanding of these principles. I won't speak for themselves, but they tend to share an understanding of these principles. That it's about organisational culture, and it's too simplistic to say good or bad. It's more about aligning. So there are, as Duncan alluded to, no one's a complete answer, and I'll try to explain why that is in some cases. So starting point is that there is a correlation between people's values and actions, right? So we feel rewarded and satisfied when we behave in a way that correlates to our values, our personal values. But people don't always act in line with those values. We don't always practice what we preach. Despite holding very strong values, people's behaviour can change depending on the circumstances. And so it's known as a value-action gap, without getting too carried away in terms of the psychology about it. But the key point here is that this so-called value-action gap, and we see it in the environmental issues, you know, people are very concerned about the environment, but who's really doing anything about it? We see it in biobehavior analysis as well. So we've got this value-action gap at play. It can create a problem in terms of diagnosing risk culture, in terms of what people say in surveys, interviews, workshops, and training, and what they actually do day to day. So why is it that people fill in their staff engagement surveys and say, yes, I understand, yes, I've got no concerns, I agree the culture here is healthy, and so forth, and yet they still behave differently? Why is that? Why is it on the one hand you can have, let's say, a good engagement survey in terms of culture and values, on the other hand you get behaviour that can almost blow the balance sheet up for the organisation? The answer that we've got in terms of starting to address that is that because even though people may hold very strong values, and they're honest values, they're not trying to game the research or game the questionnaire, very strong values, those values can be changed depending on the context and the circumstances. So this is a statement that I think is important from the way we look at culture. Whilst leadership, values, appetite, incentives, consequences, training, all those sort of structural things you hear about risk culture. You know, what are the values like? Is there a code of conduct that's been embraced? Is the risk appetite appropriate? Is the right balance there between short-term, long-term incentives, financial, non-financial incentives? All those are fine, but risk culture is also a local construct. That's a critical point in terms of the way we approach risk culture. You may be aware of the research Macquarie University did a couple of years ago. Elizabeth Sheedy and her team, reviewed or did a risk culture project with three of the major banks in Australia, around 113 business units. And one of the key findings of that research is that the most variance that they noticed in terms of risk culture in the organisation was at the business unit level. The local business unit level. That's where the most variance was in terms of misalignment or good or bad, let's say, at the local business unit level. And the statement they made around that is that, why is that? It's because behaviour is sensitive to context. What does that mean? Bottom line, it's driven by social factors, which means people are influenced by the colleagues they interact with every day. Day-to-day basis. There's no surprise here for those of us that understand behavioural economics or social learning. It's the way people understand the world around them. You may know the Nobel laureate, Daniel Kahneman, who got his prize for prospect theory, but in that was also system one, system two thinking, which basically says most of the way we think and behave is based on heuristics or what we learn from people around us. Versus system two, which is sitting back, thinking, analysing and so forth. So how does that work? Basically, the people we like and trust in our workplace are the ones that influence our behaviour. And it's a critical point, like and trust, because it isn't always the boss. It's not always leadership that drive our behaviour. How do we know who these people are? We use a process called social network analysis. This enables us to reveal what we call culture carriers, the people that really influence behaviour at that local level. These are people that we like and trust, not necessarily the boss. In fact, when we do these analyses in organisations, we don't see a direct correlation between organisational hierarchy and social network behind the scenes. The science behind this in terms of that influence is social learning and behavioural economics. Social networks, what is it? It's like an organisational x-ray. It reveals how work really gets done day to day. It's almost like you put a sort of lens on the organisation. You've got the superficial hierarchical structure at the top, which is about getting things, you know, approved, reporting and so forth. Behind that, you've got the social network structure. Up to 70% of communication and knowledge flows through that informal structure in an organisation. This is an example of the model that we use. So you've got the peripheral components that are about the structure, the formal process, but in the middle is something what we call human social network analysis, or SNA, and machine social network analysis. What does that mean? The human component, it involves an online survey for the organisation where people get a chance to tell us how they see the culture in the organisation, whether they're aligned to it or not. They then nominate who they go to for risk management issues. So the questions are, who do you see as a risk management role model? Who do you see as a risk management thought leader? Who do you go to for your risk management issues? It could be any issue. It's not just risk management. The answer invariably is not the risk expert in the area or the boss. It's people that work at that social level, people they like and trust. And with a bit of game theory framing as well, people I like and trust that can have a benefit for me. So that's fine. That's sort of like the survey we do. And of course, we all hear about survey fatigue, right? So organizations, you know, are doing surveys every other week these days. In this particular survey, we get a pretty good response of about 95%. There's a bit of a novelty factor there because you're nominating people in the process. You're actually transparently saying, I like Bob or I like June in terms of who I go to for risk management issues. So that sort of reinforces your relationship. You're more likely to answer the question or at least complete the survey. But having said that, surveys are hard to get up and hard to run all the time. Our solution to this is a project we've done with MIT Massachusetts that reinforces the human component on a dynamic basis. What it does, it looks at email data, Outlook meeting data internally. It could be Skype logs, could be phone logs. In any event, it's an algorithm that analyzes internal data. I'll give you some basic example. If I nominate Bob as the person I go to in my survey for risk management issues, following on from that, in the email analysis, I should see Harry and Bob communicating on a regular basis. I should see Bob taking less time than the average to respond to Harry because there's a special relationship there. I should see Harry needing less prompts for Bob to respond to that email because, again, there's a special relationship there. It's based on liking and trusting this relationship. If I don't see that, it means either someone's changed their view in terms of that relationship or there's something else happening in terms of the way that person perceived their relationship. In any event, it allows us to dynamically update the relationship structure, the network structure that we're trying to monitor on an ongoing basis. So MIT developed it originally about 15 years ago now, and it was all these algorithms need their training databases to start off with. MIT's one was on Enron. So when Enron imploded, MIT took the public available data, the email data, and started training their algorithm on that data. Since then, there's been about 25 major projects done. And what we do every time we do this job, we don't just use the previous data from other organizations. We also say to our client, you tell us where there's been a culture and control breakdown before, where it's been proven to be a problem. You may have moved those staff members on, but you'll have email archives. We go in and read those archives to further calibrate our tool, our algorithm. So the type of indicators we can get through this process of human and machine SNA, we can look at the type of risk culture and individual conduct evolving in the organisation. Why? Because the people that are these influencers, they're the ones that are going to define how your culture will evolve at the local level. If they're aligned to the culture, that's a good thing. If they're not aligned, that could be a bad thing. Not aligned is not a bad thing necessarily, by the way. They could be not aligned because they don't like the culture they see in the workplace. And they may be right. So, you know, you could be someone sitting on a trading floor in one of the organisations seeing the wrong type of behaviour in that sort of area and saying, I don't like the culture here. So you may actually be right. I won't take too long, but the key indicator we find our clients like is the ability of our approach to predict the likelihood of individual employee misconduct. It's a very controversial subject, obviously, and we don't put it in those black and white terms, obviously, but by being able to read the content of emails through the science of psycholinguistics, it's not about what people write, it's for how they write it. And the patterns of how that's written, we're able to sort of understand potential behaviour going forward. It's actually it's getting to the point where it's, in some cases, up to 95% accurate in terms of, you know, indicating a problem as opposed to saying someone's guilty or not guilty. How are we going with time? That's about it for me, I guess. Yeah.
Thanks, Harry. There's plenty of food for thought there in terms of an alternative way to think of risk culture, and I'm sure you will have some questions later for Harry. We'll move on now to Paul Guinard. Paul is the founder of the Capability Institute and has been engaged in understanding and developing the concept of capability for over 10 years. Previous to engaging with capability, Paul worked with several startups in the IT field, one of which he founded and was taken to the US in 2000. Some of his work has since been used in the insurance field in a product which was recognised with two innovation awards. Paul has over 25 years' experience in research, development, consulting and management. He has a PhD from the University of Melbourne and was head of the Knowledge-Based Systems Laboratory at CSIRO. Paul has published academic papers and holds several patents. So I look forward to hearing what Paul's got to say. Paul.
Thank you. I would like to take you back to the World Economic Forum in Switzerland early this year in Davos. And the main topic there was the fourth industrial revolution. To put things in context, the first one is usually summarized as the time of the steam engine, second one, electricity, the third one, perhaps the transistor, and the fourth one now is basically everything digital of a digital revolution. And you can see from the bullet points that we are already being impacted by the fourth industrial revolution, and it's going to become even more significant in the next few years. So what should we do? Well, we could try to deal with it by doing more of what we do, but perhaps better, that is, running faster. Or we could say that we need to do things differently to remain up to date. We could decide that we should invest in innovation so that we create new products, new services that add value to the organization and the market or the society. We could also decide that we need to become more agile, that is, we need to be able to change and innovate on a regular basis to take advantage of the opportunities that arise and counter threats. Finally, we probably need to be ready to deal with threats to our business models. How could we do that? Well, this is the topic for this talk, that is, we should actually engage capability, and we'll talk of culture. So what is capability? And what we do when we talk about capability, we introduce it with a truck metaphor. So you have a heavy truck, and you need to drive it up a steep pass to the top of the pass, which is your destination. And the question is, how are you going? So what people do, normally, they measure the location of a truck up the pass. And that's very important, and that's fair enough. But we say this is not sufficient. It's not telling you whether you are going to reach the top of a pass, whether you are going to reach your destination. To know that, you need to know about the engine, the transmission, the tires, and the driver. So these things are what we call capability. These are the enablers. Now, this metaphor is useful, but does not represent actually the challenge of a fourth industrial revolution. Because, in fact, the business environment can change quite radically, and it's like suddenly you were thinking that you were driving a truck up a rough road, but in fact you find yourself that you need to be driving a Formula One car on a circuit. So how are we going to do that with capability? Right, so now I come to then what is a suitable model of capability. And the one you see there has got six dimensions going from leadership and management on one side, and if I keep going clockwise towards the end there, there is rewards and appreciation environment. Now you can see that these six dimensions capture just about everything that an organization needs to be good at to actually compete successfully in the market. If the other way to look at it is if an organization is weak in one of these factors, then it will suffer quite a lot. Naturally, the model has got sub-dimension in each of these bubbles and some issues in each one, so we can have a good fine-grained description of capability. What is important here, there are several features. First one is that this model is generic, that is, it applies to all sorts of industries, it applies to different functions in the organization, and also it can apply to performance, to risk management, to safety, to agility, to innovation. Another thing that really matters about this model, and you can see it, is that it contains the essential aspects of culture. In fact, it contains what David Murray called this morning the human system and the technology system. It is at the junction at the soft and hard issues, so it's quite important. In fact, this capability is the environment in which and through which culture expresses itself. So we summarize it by saying capability contains culture. Now, we had a model, all very well, so we needed to actually validate it. And we found an organization that was BMA in Queensland a few years ago, and BMA stands for BHP Billiton Mitsubishi Alliance. These are the coal people in Queensland. And for in a small part of the organization, for 3 years, every quarter, we were measuring capability and also performance, and performance based on a scorecard with about 9 KPIs, and each one had some sub-KPIs. So here's the results there on the right. Capability, then, we were measuring these six dimensions, and then performance on the vertical axis. And the time, the first 7 quarters, you see them here from left to right. So the first one goes, the first point, I'm not sure I've got it right here. Yeah. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So it goes up that way. So what we found is that there was essentially quite a strong correlation between capability and performance. So we were measuring capability, we found gaps, let's say a problem in communication, then we would improve communication through an initiative, and it enabled us to leverage communication to improve processes, so you get better performance. No magic there. Now, so we thought we had the system validated there. Another important point is that quite a few people believe that capability is in fact pretty stable and that's performance that changes. Well, this says otherwise. It's telling us that capability from quarter to quarter can change as much as performance. So it means that we need to manage capability with the same discipline that we use to manage performance. So, now we have a model, we think it's validated. So what do we do with it? So we come to the first way of using the capability model, and that's capability at the front line. So we start, let's say, with a challenge or an activity, an objective on the left there, we develop a plan. Over time, we implement the plan, we track it with KPIs, and maybe KPIs are not as good as we think they should be. So we say, all right, let's find out what is the capability at the front line. So we do a survey, and that's what we were doing there in Queensland. So now I'm going to show you a couple of examples of results of using the model. Here on this radar display, you recognize the six dimensions. There is leadership and management there at about 1 or 2 o'clock. It goes down there at about 5 o'clock, relationships, communication, and learning. And you have rewards and appreciation environment at 11. Now, the good results are close to the outer edge. The target here is this pink band. And we here are using, in fact, a property of a generic aspect of the model to have on the same graph the capability for performance and the capability for risk. So for performance, it's in blue, and the capability for risk management is in red. So suddenly, if we think that capability is a reflection of senior management focus in one area, then we can see whether senior management is focusing equally on risk as on performance. So here, what do we see? Well, we see that overall, the red line is inside the blue line, so the capability for risk is not as good. The other thing we see is that there are areas there that are clearly below the target, both for the red line and the blue line. And the area there at around 11 o'clock, near the rewards and appreciation environment, is quite a significant one, because that's what David Murray called this morning where trust lies, or at least one of the areas where trust lies. And we saw, of course, some peaks. I'll show you the second set. And this is for a different team. And the focus here, as before, was understanding capability for risk management and in comparison with capability for performance. And the two points that stand out here are at about 2 o'clock and again at about 11 o'clock. In this case, we have a dip in the blue lines, which means that we have challenges in these areas as far as performance is concerned. So even though our focus or interest, main interest was risk management, using the model and using the property, the generic property, we could compare with performance, and we found opportunities to actually increase performance. So we think that's quite important, in fact, to situate risk management in its proper business context and take advantage of that. So now we have detected gaps. What do we do? And what normally people do, and that's what we did, then we do a feedback loop, and we want to define an initiative to improve the situation. Now, it's more easily said than done, of course. So it brings me to the second way of using the model, and we call it the execution blueprint. So let's say here again you have a challenge or an activity, or it could be also from the feedback loop that we had before, and we want to produce an execution blueprint, which is essentially a plan that engages capability in the pursuit of a certain objective. So the idea here is that if we focus on the main drivers of capability, these six dimensions that we saw before, then we pay attention early, so we are far more likely downstream to have good results when we do the measurements. And also, because of the diagram that I've reproduced here, if we look after capability, we are going to get better results as far as performance is concerned. And then we have leverage the known success factors. Now I would like to give you a practical example, and that's related to embedding RAS into the DNA of the organization. We know that RAS that isn't embedded has very limited value. I picked up on the web, there on the website of a reasonably well-known medium-sized organization, part of a RAS. And I don't know if you can read it. I think you can. I won't read it, but let's say I'm not, by training, an accountant, or an actuary, but that seems to be reasonably esoteric to me. And if I had the task of defining a set of KPIs that we could use across the organization to actually comply with this element or embed that element of RAS, then I think that would be quite difficult. So what I would like to show you is how we approach it using this execution blueprint using capability. So what we want to do here is take these six dimensions and the sub-dimensions and leverage them, find what we need to do in each of them so that we create a set of actions that is going to act in a synergetic way to take us towards the objective that we want further down the stream. So, for example, in leadership and management, for a team, we could say who should do what, when, and how, and tracking, including tracking. We may have to look at the organizational model and the processes we have, actually, for this element of the RAS. It may change the way we need to think about communication and capturing knowledge, a new knowledge. Same with the other dimensions. The last one is, of course, quite important, ensuring that we avoid conflict of interest and that we ensure alignment. So, for example, for a team, and it could be different for another team here, leadership and management, GM has got to talk every month at the staff meeting to his team to make sure that the RAS is current and have to report back to his boss. There is a new data collection model, for example, and there is real-time reporting so that they can actually manage this aspect. They need to be able to have new communication because all this data has got to be shared and the actions need to be coordinated. Otherwise, RAS isn't embedded if it's embedded only in one tiny corner of the organization. And so on, till the last one, where friendly competition, winning teams, and so on. So we have seen two ways now of using this capability model. And for each one, though I haven't talked about it much here, of course, but we have a set of web-based tools that help implement that and guide in the implementation. And that brings me to the last slide, which is the conclusion, which essentially that if we want to address the challenges associated with the fourth industrial revolution, which is about essentially to simplify the digital revolution, then I think we have got to think and act capability. If we don't do that, we are not actually leveraging the enablers of what we want to achieve. And the model of capability that we propose and we have developed here addresses the issue of culture, of behaviors, of competitiveness and risk, and enable us to make comparison between the different capabilities inside the organization and inside teams. And finally, and you have probably picked it up, is that this idea of capability essentially works because it's working on the quality of the work environment in which people and teams operate. So essentially, we are empowering people and teams inside the organization. And I think that's the way that we need to do it to get results. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. So another quite different approach to risk culture and culture broadly. I'm now going to introduce Hazel Nichols, who is a non-executive director of SCORE and will bring a quite different perspective, I suspect, to our discussion. And that's the perspective as a non-executive director. Hazel's career in the life reinsurance industry began when she joined Mercantile and General Reinsurance as, she says here, an inexperienced but enthusiastic school leaver, and she's given the year, but I won't give it for you all. In the 40 years, believe it or not, since then, she has progressed through many areas of the business, including underwriting, claims, operations, to senior management roles, and ultimately to that of Chief Executive Officer of Swiss Re Life and Health Australia, a position which she held for 6 years. She returned to life reinsurance in 2011 as an independent non-executive director on the board of SCORE Global Life Australia Limited. She's currently still a member of its board and its audit and risk committees. Hazel brings to the discussion her perspectives of having experienced the culture and conduct of boards both as an executive and non-executive director. She says that she remains enthusiastic, but is now a little more experienced. Hazel.
Thank you very much, Duncan, and good afternoon, everyone. So, yes, you did say I have quite a different approach, and my approach really is based on my experiences and ideas where I think that non-executive directors can really help with the culture in a company. And I'll start just by briefly reminding you of what we're talking about when we say culture. And these words are extracted from APRA's definition. So they say norms of behaviour. When I turn my head, do you lose my voice or can you still hear me? Is it okay? Norms of behaviour and also the ability of an organisation to identify, understand, discuss and act on the risks that affect that organisation. I'd like to make two points about this slide. The first one is that you'll notice from those four verbs in the second line, only one has been elaborated upon with an adverb, and that's openly discuss. So as a non-executive director, I don't know why APRA decided to add that word there, but for me, I interpret it as creating an environment at the board where everybody can feel comfortable about bringing any issue for discussion. And in terms of norms of behaviour, I think they've really nailed it there, actually, with that description. And if you think of the shock resignation of Sam Dastyari recently, he was quite quiet when he first resigned, but he was interviewed a few days later, and this is what he said. This is what usually happens. If you overspend on a campaign, you raise money from the sponsors. I followed standard practice. So those are the norms of behaviour in the organisation he was working at the time, and that's why he did it. In fact, Harry alluded to that in his presentation about the gap between action and your own values. So how important is it to get this right? Well, also, actually, as Harry said, there's been many millions lost as a result of having a poor culture and a poor risk conduct that's resulted from that. My first example of pain but no gain relates to a young banker who was jailed for 3.5 years after fraudulent activity, which cost billions of dollars and probably a lot more dollars in reputation that you can't quantify. After he came out of jail last year, he was interviewed at least twice that I know of by the BBC. On the first occasion, I read his interview, and this is what he said. And it's quite disappointing. This is my point about pain but no gain. Former colleagues still struggle with the same issues, the same culture, the same pressure to succeed no matter what. The drive for profit encouraged bad behaviour. Now recently, as I knew I was be talking today, I thought I'd check up my facts on this case. And I found that he'd been interviewed, in fact, just last week, last Wednesday, by the BBC again, for their Hard Talk programme, and it's still on the website if you'd like to have a look at that. And in that interview, whilst he accepts full responsibility for what he did and he accepts that he was wrong, he emphasised that unless you get the culture right in an organisation, the behaviour won't change. And it's not just actions that can be very damaging, words can too. And to illustrate this, I choose an example from about 25 years ago, which some of you may have heard of, probably the most damaging few words that have ever been said by a company director. And he was speaking to the Institute of Directors at the Albert Hall, excuse me, and he headed up a chain of high street jewellery stores. And during his presentation, he mentioned why one of the products was sold by his company so cheaply. And the reason he gave for that was, and I quote literally, "It's total crap." This had a catastrophic effect. Needless to say, he's no longer head of an organisation that has a jewellery store in every high street. And it's probably the most famous example of how words can be damaging, well, certainly that I'm aware of. So now that we've established how important it is to have the culture right and to minimise conduct risk, and it's not just actions, it can be words too, let's move inside the boardroom. And I selected these three points as my top three risks where if things aren't handled well, then you won't get the best out of the people that were there, that are there, and you might make decisions or take actions that can be damaging to the company. Now, coming at this from a non-executive point of view too, you don't know what might be going on inside the organisation that you might not be aware of. Now, this may not be anything bad. It might simply be that teams are competing for resources, or that somebody presenting to the board is hoping for a promotion. Or maybe there are two people presenting to the board who are competing for a promotion. So you may not want to ask a tricky question at a meeting and put somebody on the spot. In fact, I would venture to say nobody likes to look foolish or feel uncomfortable amongst their peers. Understanding the jargon is a big one, and I think a big one where people may sometimes lack the confidence to clarify things. And the one that comes up most for me is capital. How many different definitions of capital can there be? How do people use them interchangeably? So we have regulatory capital, prescribed capital, surplus capital, target surplus capital, free capital, etc., etc. It's very, very important in a board environment to clarify exactly what you're talking about. And as a non-executive director with a different stake in the meeting, you can be brave and lead the way by asking a question that someone might consider to be a silly question. This leads me on to the pressures of time. You will most likely have many hundreds of very technical papers, hundreds of pages of technically difficult papers to get through and make decisions. And at some point in the meeting, you'll notice those signs, surreptitiously looking at someone else's watch, sliding the smartphone into view, starting to close a folder. Don't let this put you off. Don't let this put you off making a clarification, like I suggested about jargon, or but out of my mind. What was the second point I was going to make? Don't worry, I'll come back. Oh, sorry, I know what it was. It's not. I was going to say it. Also, the time spent, maybe time saved down the track if you take the time to get things right. So don't let those signs worry you. I just want to go back to being on the spot before moving on to other ways a non-executive director can be helpful. And this is, you might think, oh, well, that's fine in those high-flying banking jobs where it's all very aggressive and people are expected to make huge profits, whatever the cost. Well, in my organisation, that could never happen. Well, I would say it can, and I would say that I nearly made that mistake, and I remember it. And that's why I'd like to share it with you. Many, many moons ago, I was sent on a training course and given a questionnaire to assess my personality type. And I remember one of the questions really clearly, and this was it. When a colleague you dislike gets their comeuppance, are you secretly pleased? Well, you can see why I'm smiling, because at the time, yes, I was. Now, we were instructed to answer the question quickly with a gut reaction, you know, don't think about it. And so I toyed with saying no so that I would get a better result. But I knew I'd only be cheating myself, so I did say yes. But the point is, me 30, 35 years ago might have taken pleasure out of putting somebody on the spot. I certainly wouldn't do it now, even if I like them intensely, because now my goal is to make the meeting flow and get everything working as well as possible. But, you know, I really believe that people could have those inclinations. Okay, so how else can non-executive directors help create a supportive culture? Well, this is the first one might seem very simple, sending questions in advance. But it does avoid that on-the-spot thing that I was just talking about. It will help the meeting flow more smoothly and help you meet the time management goals. You might even get a better answer. And you might uncover something different altogether. For example, if we're looking at the chief risk officer, you might want to ask them, has all the management been involved in identifying the risks? Do you think they've bought into it? Do you think they're all agreed on which risks we're taking and which ones we're not? and how we're going to manage those? If the answer is yes, obviously, no issue. If the answer is no, then you can work with that person to bring it to the table and try and help them find a solution. Position yourself as a resource, a member of the team that is there to help the management achieve its goals. So a board is not an examination board, not an interrogation, not the Spanish Inquisition. We're all on the same side. And don't try and spin all the plates. You'll have seen those variety acts where they put plates on poles and run along to the end and then come back again. Because if you try, some will certainly fall off. So take advantage of the experience in the room and don't be afraid to use it. I have an example of this too. If you've ever completed one of those observation tests where you'll be shown, let's say, a mugging, and then asked afterwards to be an eyewitness for the police. So people say, oh yes, the handbag was black. No, it was brown. The robber was wearing red. No, it wasn't. It was blue, and so on. And so people will have different perspectives. And then there's a facilitator might say, okay, how many of you saw the man dressed as a grizzly bear that walked straight through the video? And more often than not, nobody has, but occasionally there'll be one. So it's always worth trying to get everybody's perspective, encouraging everybody to speak, because there'll be somebody there who's seen something that nobody else has and has a very different perspective. And finally, give credit when credit's due and when it's not. When it's due, that's obvious. When it's not, I mean examples like bringing mistakes, reports of mistakes to the meeting, explaining how they happened, what you've done to try and stop them happening again, and so forth. So those sorts of things should, excuse me, be given as much credit as people reporting that everything has gone well. Other good practices. Love your auditors. Are you all auditors? I wasn't expecting anyone to laugh at that. You can't be in the business, so but they will spend weeks there. And they can be your eyes and ears. Always take full advantage of the closed sessions. I've never seen an auditor write, I'm delighted to give an unqualified audit report, despite the chaos in the organisation, the pressure those poor people are under and their terrible systems. You won't find that in an audit report. So your time at your closed session is to ask about these softer factors and find out what their observations are. Don't forget to applaud the silver medals. If that's your risk appetite, if it's not going for gold, we have a tendency to focus on the gold medal winners, don't we? We've just had the Olympics and the Paralympics, and I hate it when you see a crestfallen silver medal winner sloping off in the background as though they were a failure. It's still a fantastic achievement, and we must applaud those too. Seeking evidence of soft skills. I'm thinking here about recruitment for senior management, for new non-executives coming onto the board. You won't find that on the CV as a general rule. There'll just be a list, lots of qualifications, years of experience, usually loads of jobs in whatever important leaps until they get to this stage. But rarely will you find any evidence of their soft skills. So you want to know really how they achieved all those things. What trail of destruction could they have left behind them? So think about asking when you're getting referees or when you're interviewing the person, ask them, you know, tell me a way in which you motivated your team. Try and find a bit about the softer side. And finally, don't be a Rottweiler. Now, this is one of the most important lessons I learned along the way. And it came about not at a board meeting, but a senior management meeting where someone was presenting a new product. And they tried to find out who was going to be at the meeting so they would know their audience. You know, so who am I presenting to? And I'm very sad to say that somebody told them that I was going to be there and that I was like a Rottweiler. Now, I apologise to all owners of Rottweilers and indeed to the Rottweilers themselves, because I understand that they are very lovable and very obedient pets, and this isn't what he meant. He meant that he thought I was aggressive and intimidating, and of course I was horrified. because that wasn't my intention at all. I asked lots of questions because I was interested and I wanted to see, well, what if we do? What if it goes wrong? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So feedback is a gift, a very important lesson, and also illustrates that it may not be just actions and words, but also body language that can have an impact on the culture. So to wrap up, I've almost gone into my wrap up actually. So norms of behaviour that create your risk culture include everything: actions, words, expressions and body language. The non-executive directors have a unique opportunity to lead the way by the way they behave to create a good risk culture in an organisation. And finally, I say be brave, because you may get the odd little dent in your ego along the way if you ask a question that you think someone else might think is a bit silly, but you will bounce back and you will recover. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Hazel, and I'll invite our three presenters to come up to the front. And I'm going to open it straight up. I have some questions if you don't have any, but I'm going to open it straight up to the audience. If you can make sure you get a microphone if you're going to raise a question so people on the webinar can hear, that would be great. So do I have a first question? Who's going to be brave for the first one? Oh, one at the back, yeah.
Hi, Gavin Pearce from Insurance in Care New South Wales. Harry, I certainly echo the statement you made about, you know, it's too simplistic to think about a good and bad culture. And looking at, you know, obviously APRA asking boards to have a view on risk culture, they don't go that next step of, you know, how do you decide what is the right culture? And more importantly, how do you change it if there's a gap between what you've got and what you want?
So is that a question for APRA? Or for
we did hear a bit about measuring culture,
yeah.
And view on culture, but you know, how do you then say, well, that's fine, I wanted a red shiny one and I've got a red shiny one?
Yeah, I think without wanting to speak for APRA, I think they wouldn't necessarily talk about measuring culture, they'd probably talk about assessing culture. I know it's sort of splitting hairs, but they probably would say it that way. Having said that, in my humble opinion, I think APRA is probably at the forefront of looking at culture globally in terms of regulators for financial services organisations. And everyone's grappling with this, you know, concept of how do we get a handle on what's really happening when no one's watching, when no one's looking, you know. And I guess from a personal perspective, part of the answer for me at least is once you've got all those structural factors in place, you know, risk appetite, values, codes of conduct, balance in terms of risk and reward and so forth, it's a case of how you're able to influence behaviour at that local level, at that coalface. And I guess that's a sort of, you know, question that we're hopefully starting to answer as well. But I take your point that it's certainly a sort of a area for more discussion.
I think in some ways, my own view as well, it would be much easier if APRA did specify these things, but I think they've been quite deliberate in not, actually. And I think that's probably a very wise course by APRA. We actually have to work it out ourselves. Paul, did you want to?
Yes, I'd like just to add something in relation to the model that I presented. So we have the six dimensions that represent essentially the behavior space as set up by the human and technical systems of the organization. And the targets that we can set, or the target range, you remember perhaps this pink circle on one of the diagrams, then that's something that the board can decide this is what we think is acceptable. For example, in the area that was lacking about trust, which was the rewards and appreciation environment, then the board, in my view, should take an interest if really we are below the target there, because it's not only that people are not happy about their salary, it's that they raise a problem of trust in the organization and in the way it operates. So I feel that we can take a proactive view on that problem.
Thank you. I'm going to move to another question if there is one. There's a question over here. Yeah. Microphone's just on its way. So,
Graham Poyser from Suncorp. My question's for Harry. Harry, in terms of the analytical piece you talked us through at the beginning, when you're comparing actual behaviour with, I guess, what people say and what people do, can you use that to predict, you know, potential hotspots or people who might be prone to moments of madness in an otherwise sort of rational behaviour?
That's a really good question. And the basis of this discussion from our point of view is really you can really honestly and vehemently believe in a certain type of value system. And by the way, there's a lot of research that says your personal values can be adjusted depending on how strong the organisation embraces its own values. So even though your personal values may not be aligned to the organisation's, you're more likely to actually adapt to the organisation's values if they really live those values. So it's not that important what your personal values are in terms of coming in. It's much more important as to how strongly the organisation really lives those values in terms of how it'll influence you. But having said that, no matter how strong the organisational values are on the, you know, board that you walk past every day to go to the canteen, or how many policies you say you've read and how many surveys you've filled in, ultimately you will be influenced more by the people you like and trust. That's the way we learn. That's the way we take on behaviour. That's how knowledge becomes habit and our habits transferred through the organisation. So the key question is, who are these people actually liked and trusted? And when we do our survey, it's not always a leadership team. So you can't just look at the organisational chart and say, right, our leaders are the right ones for this organisation in terms of driving culture. Yes, that's absolutely necessary. You've got to have that in place. But that can be undermined depending on who's really influencing people at that local level.
Thanks, Harry. We've got time for one more question, so I'm just going to take this one at the back.
Harry, Ben Weldon here from RSA. I have a question specific for you, but happy if anyone else on the panel wants to answer. What kind of research has been done around the comparison between perhaps non-for-profit organisations versus financial services in relation to their purpose as an organisation? So, most organisations who are joining non-for-profit, strong value systems based on the direction and the purpose of that organisation. Is it perhaps the dilution of an organisation's purpose in financial services at that subcultural level that's leading to perhaps some of the problems that we're seeing?
Hazel, do you want to have a go at that, or do you want to leave it to Harry to go first? Because I think there's quite a... Do you want to go? Go on.
So... tone from the top is a critical factor in all this discussion, and as part of our model, we also review and analyse the culture in the boardroom itself. In fact, that's where most of our business originally started, by doing board reviews. And so if the tone from the top isn't right, then it won't be right for the rest of the organisation. Having said that, when it comes to being influenced, there are three levels of influence. There's information, so you can see a lot of things and take it in or not take it in. There's observation, how you see your leadership behave, and then there's interaction. The strongest form of personal influence is that personal interaction. So if the values are correct for the people that are interacting daily with the ones that matter, then whether they're not-for-profit or financial services, I think it's academic. We've seen dysfunctional boards and dysfunctional organisations, not-for-profits, and vice versa. In fact, the worst one we've ever done is for a not-for-profit in terms of job. I'm sad to say that it ended up in the chair being removed because the culture was so dysfunctional. And what we do find is that people that tend to join not-for-profit boards aren't always the ones that are best suited to the role. They may be the ones that can raise the most, donations. They may be the ones that have got more time on their hands, without casting any aspersions, of course.
And we won't ask for names and details, but I'm sure Harry will be willing to give them afterwards. I'm going to wrap it up there because we're out of time. But Harry, Paul and Hazel, I'm sure, will be around afterwards if you want to grab them to ask them a question on their particular area. I'd like to also join me in thanking them for their unique and insightful presentations and insight into what is a complex area. So thank you to each of them. Have a small group. And that's it for this session. There'll be a short break before the next session starts. Thank you very much.